Hey guys, welcome back to another episode of the Spates Waddle Ed podcast. How good is Spates, honestly? Produce the best beer and absolute lads for sponsoring the Waddle Ed podcast season 4, where the guests just keep on coming. Really looking forward to this one. I'm super excited with the guests we have on. But cheers to our mates at Spates for sponsoring this episode. Also, Waddle Ed fans, you do not have to wait any longer with new Waddle Ed tees now available. If you enjoy the podcast and you want to be a true lad, head over to waddleed.com now and go get yours. Also, the great Pure Sport are back on board, and now here on New Zealand shores, Pure Sport pride themselves on bringing together the best of science and nature. Their unique products are scientifically formulated to support mind and body well-being. I've been using their products for over 3 years now. It helps out my hip issues immensely. And I've also been taking the mushroom bundle recently, and I can mentally feel the difference on those. If you're keen to try some of these great products, head over to puresport.com and go check them out. There we go. What a lad. Well, with the Rugby World Cup just around the corner, there's only one man we all need to hear from right now. He was the one who was responsible for keeping the country calm as he guided the All Blacks to the 2011 Rugby World Cup. As well as being one of the all-time All Black greats, he's also a true Wellington and Hurricane legend who has also had stints for Auckland and the Blues, London Welsh, the Wasps in England, and a couple of other clubs that are hard to pronounce in France. And of course, he finished with the mighty Wairarapa Bush. Since footy, he's been the star of his own TV show. He's also been on the reality show Match Fit for a couple of seasons now. Everyone knows that he is a lad. He's actually one of the great lads. It is, of course, Pity Weepu. Welcome, brother.
Thank you, brother. I don't know about the intro. It's a bit full on, man.
But too much. We all know you're a very humble man. I know you don't even really talk about being an All Black and all that sort of stuff anymore, eh? You like to keep it very low key.
Oh, you've been talking to some of my cousins and friends. Well, I don't speak too much about my career much, but yeah.
Do people still recognise you out on the street and stuff?
Yep, I actually had a few people ask me for a photo the other day, but it wasn't because of the photo, it was because of my TV series now.
Oh, true, yeah.
We watch your show all the time, and yeah. I'm like, sure.
Oh, that's cool, though, eh?
Yeah, and plus, like, more recently, a lot of people have been not slagging me, mostly all my mates anyway. I've been going to a few functions, I've been rocking up in my red band, so they're slaying me when I'm, like, going to a tidy event. Everyone's wearing suit, dress shoes and all that, and all Maori boys rocking up with bloody red bands.
I did see that, actually. Where was that? That was like a function somewhere, right? With Colin Slade.
Yeah, Slady. Yeah, Slady in Forsyth Bar had organised a breakfast, and there was Jonah and Victor were sort of on a panel, and Ken was there, and I think I've spoken to a few people since then, and I said they're probably I'm the first person I've ever seen walk into the Wellington Club with a red band in an event that looked very, very tidy.
You couldn't convince Victor to wear the red bands as well.
Oh, nah. I think because he seen me a week before at a luncheon, and I was rocking my red bands then, and he was like, you know, actually, I couldn't get away with that. I said, that's because you're a Scotch education, mate. Your Scots college education wouldn't allow you to wear something like that.
Mate, you could bring it back. How good would that be? Everyone just wearing gumboots to functions, save the dress shoes, the worst shoes ever.
As long as they're not bloody dirty, usually, like if they're putty from being out on the farm or trying to act like I go hunting, you just put them at the front door and you're rocking your socks, mate.
Yeah, you'd need one clean one and one for use. And obviously, you're out all the time now. Are you still recording your show?
Not at the moment. Like we've finished finished editing the TV series, and that's going to go to air in October.
True. Is that season 3?
Season 6.
Season 6. Holy heck!
Yeah,
man.
Well, the dream, the bros' idea, Bailey's idea was to try and have 71 episodes.
Yeah.
I played 71 tests and I thought, oh, is that a stretch, cuz? Like, are we going to be making it that far? But I think, yeah, I think this year might have been there or thereabouts, I think.
All right, how cool is that? Are you loving it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's been awesome. Like, just, you know, you go to, people talk about all these places, and, you know, you sort of just fly in, fly out. Mm. You don't actually get to meet, like, the actual people that live there on a day-to-day basis kind of thing. So meeting heaps of locals that just love hunting, fishing, yeah, diving, just gathering food. But not only that, they don't just do it for themselves. They actually, you know, give it out to the community too.
Yeah.
And that's been the best part about it, the most rewarding part, is the every person that I've gone out with, you know, they've all got something in common, which is, they might go out, their freezers might be full, so they just go and fill everyone else's freezers.
Oh, that's cool, eh?
And, like, the best thing is, like, when you go to someone that does hunting, you take seafood to them, bro, you come back with, like, venison and wild pork. It's so good. And then vice versa, everyone that lives on the or near the ocean, you know, if you take wild meat to them,
yeah,
they'll happily take that off you for a bit of kai.
Right, how good is that? And how did that even come about? How did you fall into the whole Pity's Tiki Tours?
I got asked when I was living in Auckland from Bailey if I'd be interested in, you know, presenting a TV show. And in my head I was thinking, am I even going to be good enough to sort of present a TV series? But then I ended up signing and going overseas.
Yeah.
So I ended up, I was like, I forgot to tell him that, you know, he was like, what happened to you? What would you, sorry, because just going to go overseas for a couple of years and have a nosy at the competition. And then if it's still on the table, then yeah, sweet. But yeah, had a kōrero when I was living in Auckland, went away, come back from overseas. And the network were pretty keen. Māori TV was still keen to, well, they asked if I was still keen.
Mm.
And I was like, yeah, sweet. Keen, that's us.
Yeah.
So, it, yeah, it started from about 3 years beforehand. And then when they said if I was still interested, I was like, I'm not doing anything else. Yeah, why not? Might as keep myself busy.
Yeah, and what was it like doing it? Were you nervous? Obviously presenting and hosting your own show. Especially the release, I'd imagine, eh? Like, probably more so releasing it to the world.
Well, you think about it. When we're all those years of us doing press conferences for, like, you know, bloody media and all that, we're real short and sharp with our answers.
Yeah.
So we don't give too much away. I remember the first episode we did, which was down in Arahura in Hoki, where my family's from. And I did it with my cousin and my uncle. And they were asking me questions in my master interview. And I was real short with my answers just because, you know, that's what we've been.
Yeah.
Told to pick three things. Yeah, exactly. Get three things. Make sure you push these three subjects and then just keep honing in on that. So I was real short and sharp with my answers. And because the best part is my older brother was a camera operator.
Oh, true.
So Billy was there and he was like, hang on. Oi, you can actually open up. It's not like media, you know, where you're real short and sharp. So he knew straight away.
Yeah.
And after that, yeah, I felt all good after that. I guess it helps that I had my older brother there the whole time.
Yeah.
So it's been good. We've been sort of doing this together.
Oh, true. So he's one of the film men on the show.
Yeah. So he's worked for TV3 for years because he used to come up to training up at Rugby League Park and, you know, try and pick an angle where he's trying to say that I've got the fattest ass in the family by getting shots of me from behind. I'm like, mate, you're looking really awkward right now with some of these pictures. But, yeah, he did that for years. And then I thought, you know, if they ask, I was like, I'll only do it if my older brother is the camera operator. And we've been doing it together since.
Far out. And just plans to keep going, keep on rolling?
Oh,
maybe a movie.
Nah, no way. We've already done that. Troy Kingi was me.
Oh, true.
They picked the perfect guy. I mean, my voice is real good. Not. But well, at the moment, like we're sort of in a stage where after this season, the funding hasn't sort of isn't going to continue.
Okay.
But what we're going to do is try and find, see if we can find sponsorship around. I know it's a bit tough at the moment with a bit of a recession and all that.
Mm.
But we're going to try and figure out how we can make a plan to see if we can still continue the dream.
Surely. Well, with all the Woodlad listeners listening who love the show, they'll be getting in behind you, and surely it will keep going forever, that show. It is one of the greats. But one thing I am keen to hear from you is a little bit more about your upbringing. I know you grew up in Wainui Mata. People love it out there. It's a pretty cool community when you're involved by the sounds of it. What was it like for you growing up out there?
Oh, man, it was awesome. I guess you don't sort of have the freedom that these kids have these days, where you can just walk down the street with a ball and your mates. And we probably shouldn't have done a few things, like pass the ball across the road to your cousin or your mate on the other side of the road and try and do it before a car comes.
That's how you got your quick pass.
Yeah, mate, oh, don't hit the windscreen. But, I mean, I've got lifelong friends that I grew up with. Some of them played in the NRL. I started one of my other best mate with our rugby career together with Namir. Mm. So we started together in 2003, literally retired. Well, I wouldn't say retired, but we pretty much finished our career together in Narbonne.
Yeah.
It was awesome. I mean, my second home, other than mum and dad's house, was the league club, Wanui League Club.
Oh, yeah.
And so, you know, Tyrell's dad was there, Johnny, but his three brothers, there's four of them. But the Lomax family is a big part of our league club and our family up there. Sure. Kim Laban, as everyone would hear him, he's one of the commentators for our NPC and Super Rugby, and was on the World Series for the Sevens.
Yeah.
Tana, Namir, and myself, we pretty much started our careers at the league club. Everything we learned was through the league club, and then it's quite funny because we all became All Blacks too. With a massive league background. Tyrell's the same. Tyrell grew up playing league.
Do you remember him as a kid?
Yep, because he was hanging out quite a lot with my nephew.
Oh,
they're Josh. They're pretty much the same age, so those two were like this, and they still are today. But yeah, it was just, you know, I used to live quite a bit at my auntie's house with my cousins or at my grandmother's. Mm. And when I had when we went to intermediate, I used to go to intermediate with Namir as well. And so sometimes he'd walk past my grandparents' house, pick me up, we'd go to school. After school, we'd come back, because my grandparents are like always trying to feed all myself and my mates and all my cousins. He used to just go and help himself. He was part of the furniture. So he'd be coming in, a couple other mates that I grew up with that lived just around the corner too, they'd come over, have a feed, go home, and be like getting a growling because they bloody had a massive feed in it. What are they bloody doing? Is showing, you're supposed to hide all the evidence, mate. But I enjoyed my upbringing in Wainui. Small community, pretty much everyone knew everyone.
Mm.
I was running around at the league trainings at the age of five, following my dad, and then obviously ball boy for the Lion Red, back in the Lion Red days, in the late 80s, early 90s, we had guys that went over to the NRL, Yogi Rogers, Ali Davies, David Lomax, and obviously Johnny as well. Tana had a chance to go, but he obviously come home, got a bit homesick, come home, and I guess the rest is history with him.
Yeah.
Become one of the greats as a player for the Hurricanes, Lions, and the ABs.
So is that how you sort of moved into Union as well? Were you watching his path, or how did you end up going to Union?
Oh, not by choice.
True.
I went to boarding school and all they had was rugby.
Oh, yeah.
So I went to a Māori boarding school called Te Aute in the Hawke's Bay. And before I got there, my older brother had already been there. And they knew, after my brother was there, they knew that I'd probably go AWOL on a Sunday just to go and play games of league on a Sunday.
Yeah.
Play rugby Saturday, try and hitchhike into bloody Hawke's Bay into Hastings and try and scab a game of league. But because my brother did that before I got there, they kept a close eye on me. So I pretty much started playing like properly when I got to college. I had probably two games before that at intermediate.
Oh, really? Far out.
It was only because a couple of my mates were, the team was short at intermediate, and they were like, oh, come and have a jam. I was like, but I don't even know the rules. There's too many rules. And they're like, no, all good. I remember first game I played, I tried to stand up and play the ball. Tried to play the bloody ball, and I was like, I don't think I was supposed to do that. But they were looking at me, cracking up. I was like, oh, you're sweet then. They tell me.
So you didn't know any of the rules, really? You didn't watch rugby, didn't watch the All Blacks or anything growing up?
No, not at all. Like, obviously, being at boarding school, I did learn a little bit about rugby up there. But, yeah, even then, can we turn the league on? I don't want to watch rugby, I want to watch league.
Yeah,
but by the time I got to my senior year, you know, I actually had a bit more interest in trying to watch a bit more rugby. But, yeah, the only reason I started playing is because I got sent to boarding school and they didn't have league.
Man, that's crazy. You must have been pretty good at league then. Like,
I was all right. I went and played in a Rangatahi tournament, Māori's tournament, and got scouted there. But I had already signed an academy contract for Wellington and the Hurricanes. So,
What age was that? What age did you sign your Hurricanes one? Straight from this intermediate,
18.
Playing the ball.
Nah, from me. Yeah, I'm striking the ball back. I was 18.
Oh yeah,
when I signed it. So I obviously there's like the secondary schools tournaments, like Hurricane schools and all that, where you can get looked at. And then, you know, you play in those tournaments where you play the Southern teams, the two Auckland teams, and obviously the Hurricane region. So, yeah, got signed at 18 with an academy contract. I didn't think much of it at the time.
Yeah,
I was just like, oh, yeah, well, whatever.
Yeah,
see what happens from it. But yeah, once I mentioned to them that I was in an academy contract, I was like, nah, very well, good. You should take me because I wasn't getting paid.
True.
You know, it was just to try. I think it was just to try and lock me and keep me in Wellington.
Yeah.
But there were one guy was chasing me quite, you know, hard out. And I just said, look, I don't know if I can do anything about it because of this academy stuff that I've signed. But if you want to come back in 3 years' time, when I'm finished, yeah, sweet.
A 3-year academy contract for nothing.
Yeah. Yeah, just do trainings early in the morning and at night before bloody club.
Were you always a halfback in Union?
No, actually I was they just put me wherever, really.
Oh, true.
No, obviously my first year at college, they just put me at we just had a crack wherever.
Yeah.
Just wanted to I pretty much played the whole back line, even though I wasn't a fast person. I don't know why they put me on the wing. I wasn't that quick. Back myself though, but obviously, with my background, I tried to see if I could go into the midfield, try hit it up a bit more.
Yeah.
Wasn't as big and strong as bloody some of the boys, so they just put me in a bit closer, and I've just been playing 9 and 10 since. Mostly 10.
Yeah, when did you start really honing in on your craft as a 9, as a halfback?
Probably when I left school.
Oh, really? This Academy 18 sort of year?
Or just playing club, really.
Oh, yeah.
I played club for Harrow Boys Marist, and they weren't a premier team or club at the time, but the goal was to try and help elevate them into the premier league in Wellington.
Oh, yeah.
And I still remember, like, even with some of the old boys in the team, I was that confident that I wanted to play every position. I played second 5-8 in a couple in one game, and the coach after goes, "Yeah, no, nah, we'll stick to putting you at 10 or 9." Eh? But yeah, I spent most of my time at 9 and 10.
What did you prefer?
10, because I don't want to dig in into a ruck and pass the ball. You get pulled back into it sometimes, those bloody rucks.
So you wanted to play league and then you wanted to play 10, but you somehow end up being All Black 9.
Yeah, probably wasn't the fastest either. Bloody, or the tallest, bloody Jimmy was bloody huge. Standing next to him, old Dong is like up here and I'm like way down here. And I'm like, bro, can you like lose some of your height so I don't look so bloody short?
And then what was it like going into the Wellington setup? Because how old were you when you had your first named in the Wellington Lions?
20.
Man, so it all happened pretty fast, eh?
Well, I was 19 turning 20.
So year and a half sort of setup of playing 9, going to these academy sessions, and you're in there. Which was a stacked Wellington team too at the time too.
Oh, yeah, I was just grateful that Cully was on the team, Spiny, Lomi Fatal, Jonah had made a few appearances. I know, you know, obviously the big guy was sick. But, you know, just to have him in the team was like, I was just because you watch some of the clips of him and what he's done and just put the game on the map, you know. Just to have him there at trainings, and it was mean. It was mean just to rub shoulders with him. But yeah, it was a pretty stacked team. I remember I actually talked about this last night. I was at a speaking engagement and
with the gumboots on.
Yeah, it was civil contractor, so I felt right. I was at home, but I was just telling them, you know, we played against Salford. That was my first game for Wellington Lions, and I was nervous. And Namir was on the team as well, so the both of us were bringing nervous, as you know, young, nervous. So we actually rung our mates and went to town, went down to Courtney Place to go to Time Zone.
Yeah.
We spent a good 2, maybe 3 hours just playing freaking laser tag, you know, playing games and things like that. And we went back to the hotel and basically we didn't even feel nervous after that. It was like, it was almost like a relaxation sort of thing, just to get everything off us, all the nerves out of our system. And it happened. We did that quite a few times in our first year. And yeah, looking back now, I remember when I mentioned that last night, they all looked at me like, did you go out in town? I said, no, I didn't go out. I went out with my mates to go time zone so I can bloody go and play Spaces.
Did you do that throughout your career, like before the World Cup or anything like that when you were nervous? Did you head back to your roots of time zone?
Everything changed. We started having card games now.
Oh, yeah.
You know, stop the bus. I think kids call it 3 up, 3 down these days. Presidents and, you know, assholes. All those games. And, like, I remember, you know, it started off with just a few of us, and then it just started getting bigger and better, bigger. And then the boys started getting real competitive. Mm-hmm. So it got to the stage where we had, if there was 6 of us playing, and there'd always be a waiting list. Boys would be just sitting there waiting to get in. So as soon as you got knocked out and whatever it was, you're out, next person's in. And you're just sitting there waiting like, oh, hurry up, man, speed these games up so I can have a chance to come back in. So, yeah, it went from bloody Spaces to cards.
Oh, how good. And even like when you'd made Wellington, did you love Union at this stage, or were you still like wishing to be a league player?
I still wanted to be a league player, but I was grateful that, you know, I had worked hard enough to sort of get a foot in the door.
Yeah.
And then from there, I just had to learn. Obviously, you know, she's a bit different when you're just a kid. Raw is just out there, sometimes you just don't care, just want to have a crack, dummy, yeah. Try and run through someone, get smashed backwards, and you just keep trying until you actually get through. So it was I thoroughly enjoyed my first season. I had the likes of Spicy to learn off in terms of, I guess, understanding the ins and outs of a nine and learning my craft through him. But not only that, at club, had guys that helped me out and that I could rely on or lean on if I needed a hand with something out on the field. And, after the end of the 03 NPC comp, I actually got named, which was a shock. I didn't think I was good enough to actually be named in the Hurricane squad in 2004. So, yeah, I didn't think I'd done enough to be considered to be selected in that squad, and I didn't even think I done enough to be a part of the whole campaign.
Right, but you obviously had, because you were playing that first year pretty much straight away from memory, weren't you?
Pretty much.
Goal kicking and everything.
Oh, a little bit, not so yeah. much. The beauty of it all is, I spent some time with Ricky Flutie. He was a senior when I was at TA, Ricky Flutie.
Oh, true, okay.
So I used to have to be his ball boy. I used to practice his kicks during the week. And he must have known, this little punk will know how to kick. So he was kicking goals and I had to bloody kick them back to him and stuff like that. So it was good having Flutes as a senior, looked up to him at school. He made, New Zealand schools and all that at the time. And just to have him at the Canes as well, just made things a lot easier for me to sort of try and help myself out and get into the team and see what I can do or what I can learn from the old heads, and obviously learn a bit more about structures and game plans and trying to stick to it, not try and do your own thing.
Yeah, was it an intimidating team to go into? Obviously, heaps of legends, some quite intimidating faces as well.
No, it was actually quite inviting. Yeah, they might look ugly and scary on the TV and on the field, but they actually sort of it was the same when I made the All Blacks. It felt like I had been in the team for a couple of years already. The hardest part, it wasn't so much meeting the boys and all the legends and, fanboying at some of them. It was more, as soon as you met your teammates, you had to go and do your testing. So obviously back then it was the old 3K time trials, phosphate decrement, sprint. Oh, man. I'd never done all that kind of stuff before.
Yeah.
Wasn't one of my favorite bloody tests to do. And then I remember trying to, we did bench press squats and all that, chin-ups. Man, I could hardly pull myself up on the chin rack, and bloody, they were making us push 60 kilos on the bench, and I couldn't even push that. By the time I had finished my career, I was happy because I doubled my bloody bench. I was benching 120, so I was happy that I actually got better at that.
So this is when you join the Hurricanes. That's your testing.
Yeah. It was the 3K, and then after that we had to do the phosphate decrement, which is 40-meter sprints, and it's 10, and all timed. And then you've got you walk 5 meters, come back 5 meters, and then they count down, and you've just got to try and stick to the same timing every time. But yeah, honestly,
you look like you absolutely loved it.
Yeah, I loved it. All right.
They did have a pretty tough year from memory that first year you were in there, but they did get better each year over the next following years up into the sort of fog final. I know you're a big part of that game. What do you remember about that one?
It was actually foggy. I actually got knocked down in that game.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, I actually put my head in the wrong place. I copped the knee from Kevin Senior. I went to try and make a tackle on him. Got kneed, was out cold. I'm sure, I think if you look back on the footage, you can just sort of make out that someone's lying on the ground. And I tried to, I slowly come, well, I wouldn't say I came to, but got up, got checked, carried on. And then I missed the tackle against Casey Laulala. Even when I'm not foggy, I probably would have missed that tackle too. But I didn't actually know what was happening until about 1 o'clock in the morning.
The next day?
I was out with the team, and my older brother was there with me, keeping an eye on me. But, we were out, and I actually was like looking around going, hey, is the game finished? Yeah, mate, it's 1 o'clock in the morning. He's like, no, bro, we got to go.
Far out.
So I ended up going back to the hotel, and basically, yeah, just went straight to sleep because I didn't know what the hell was going on. And I just wanted to make sure that everything was sweet when I woke up earlier on that morning.
Man, that is crazy.
The boys asked, do you remember the penalty kick that you did? I was like, what penalty?
And did you play the whole game like that?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. I played the whole game like that.
I suppose no one could see that you were struggling.
Nah, bloody our team doctor and physio were both on the sideline, the opposite sideline where I got knocked out. Oh, they wouldn't have seen anything. See
it. The coaches wouldn't have seen it.
No.
Can never find the footage. You're just out there absolutely battling.
Pretty much. An autopilot.
And that was before the sort of concussion protocols and all that had come in. Eh? It was still pretty old school back then. You shake them off and you get back into it.
Yeah, pretty much. I'm just grateful that that was the last game. So I wasn't trying to back up the week after.
Yeah.
And try and figure out what the bloody hell happened the week before.
Far out. Would you have stayed out there now, knowing what you know now?
I probably would.
Yeah.
Just because, you know, none of us ever want to go off the field unless we've got a broken leg. Mm. Like, you got to drag us off the field in order to get us off. And I think, I'm not saying that's the attitude to have, but back then you never really, you just wanted to be on the field to go to war week in, week out. And when that number come up on the sideline and it showed your number, you would have been pissed off and stuff like that. But, you know, I know with the protocols, I understand that as a coach now, that, you know, you've got to take care of your players. Whereas obviously, you know, they're thoroughly checking boys, even ones that have taken a head knock, but, you know, are absolutely fine.
Yeah.
But, you know, just to make sure that they haven't had like a delayed concussion of some sort or anything like that. But yeah, if I was still running around, I'd still be trying to run, stay out there as much as possible.
Yeah. And you obviously can't remember the game, but do you remember like walking out there that day or like the whole fog situation, playing in it?
I remember going to the game on the bus and how foggy it was. I'm like, surely we're not playing in this. Surely it's going to lift. But all I remember was the national anthems.
Yeah.
Our national anthem, and that was it.
Yeah, done.
And so, but I do remember sort of leading up to the game and to the national anthem. After that, everything's a blur.
Mate, I was in the stands that day. I remember driving down from Nelson to come watch the Mighty Canes get their first ever victory. Couldn't see a thing. Absolutely gutted.
Oh, exactly. The worst part is you try and do a box kick. The boys are chasing it, but how are they going to see where the ball's coming? Even later, I was talking to Rico because Rico was on the wing. He goes, "Cause I had no idea where that ball was coming from. You just had to wait for the thud. And as soon as you heard the thud, oh, that sounded pretty close."
It's one of those games that you'll always remember, or you won't always remember, but everyone will remember the whole situation because it was just one of those things where it was like so crazy, so bizarre.
Oh, hard out. Like, I think for us, we wish that we probably could have sort of, you know, continued to more like postpone the game and play another day.
Yeah.
Just so that we could actually see what we're doing and have a proper crack at, you know, the opposition that way.
Yeah, you were flying that year too, eh?
Wasn't too bad.
And then obviously the following year, 2007, Rugby World Cup rolls around. You were in the All Blacks at the time, but you missed out on World Cup selection. What was that like to deal with?
Oh, it was tough because as soon as you get told, it's like they're pushing you out the door to get the hell out of there so that the boys can, the next boys can come in without, you know, it being awkward.
Mm.
There's also the letter of us, like the backboners or the DDs that week. Thursday nights is usually, you know, the night for the DDs where we get to go out and just, you know, have our night out. And so obviously there was all this bloody rubbish around, letters being given to put on the Ted's bloody door about me and a few of the other boys being out and all that. Two nights before a bloody a test. And so when that all started coming out after, I was like, you can't get onto our floor. The only ones that can get onto our floor are people that are actually staying at the hotel, and they've got to be having, I mean, they've got to have a key to get access to our floor. So clearly you guys are talking yarns.
Yeah.
So it kind of, you know, it kind of was a tough pull to swallow. I remember once I got told, pack my bag as quick as I could, jumped in the vehicle that took us to the airport. Just as we did that, the other van showed up and I realised who they picked over me. So Andy jumped out of the van and walked in, and I'm just like, oh, okay. So you went with him.
Yeah.
All good.
True. So there's no conversation or anything about what was happening. You were just told you're gone.
Oh, pack your bags. Pretty much. They tried to sugarcoat it, but the way I saw it was, all right, sweet. You don't fucking want me. All good.
Yeah.
And then after that, I went home and tried to figure out whether I hang around or if I go to Aussie and try and have a crack at my dream.
True. Was that legit? You went back looking at league clubs?
Oh, no, I didn't look at league clubs, but I knew in my head, okay, these guys don't want, it was a waste of time me staying around. If I'm not going to, if I didn't get looked in right now to play in this World Cup, then clearly I don't need to be here. And so all I needed to do was just finish, because we still had NPC, so all I needed to do was finish my campaign with NPC. Once that's done, then I was keen to try and go and see some clubs over in Aussie.
How close did you get?
Oh, I ended up, my agent told me that I had about 3 offers on the table, but I had a yarn to my older brother, Billy, and he said to me that I wasn't allowed to go. Like, he said to me, nah, you've got a job to do here. You've got a point to prove. Yeah, it might take 4 years. It's going to be 4 years of hard work. You're going to be in and out, but you've got a point to prove just to shut them up. And so I didn't end up, so gutted, because, like, had the 2 contracts there. And, it, like, to me, it wasn't, like, so much about the money. It was more the dream, like
what you loved. Yeah.
Yeah. And so for that to be sitting, you know, all I had to do was say, yeah, sign. And then my brother's like, no, you ain't going nowhere. You've got 4 years to work to get this right.
It's crazy. Crazy how close everything was, eh? Sliding doors, where you'd be now and how all your life would be. If you did just say yes. What clubs were they?
Nah, the Warriors went on the table. I think it was the Titans and the Bulldogs.
Oh, true.
I've been a Broncos fan since day dot. I reckon if they had to put one in front of me, I probably would have signed it straight away.
Oh, yeah. Man, that's crazy. But then obviously your brother's words of wisdom did work out, because 4 years later you are named in the Rugby World Cup squad. What was it like? Because you'd come off a pretty rough year with the Hurricanes too that year too.
Well, because we had, I was still coming back from a broken leg. I broke my leg in NPC.
Oh, that's right. That was a nasty one too.
Yeah, I had a fracture dislocation. The old ankle was out this way. Oh, I think, you know, the best part was that the strap, I think the strapping tape saved me a longer recovery.
Oh, yeah.
Like in terms of like, you know, if my ankle wasn't strapped, I reckon it would have been a lot longer in terms of the recovery side of it.
Come off.
So it was definitely a struggle for me. And, you know, coming off that and then starting training, I mean, I'm going to the gym by myself at stupid o'clock just to not be anywhere near the team,
yeah,
but still to get my job, get my training in. And, oh, man, I'm not going to lie, I was in some dark places during that time just because I hate doing the same stuff over and over. Mm. Like, it felt like all the trainings I was doing was very repetitive. And I tried to explain it to my trainers, and I was just swearing at them the whole time. Like, oh, I was probably not the best guy,
yeah,
to be training at that time. But my brother started coming along, helping me out, pushing me through it. Not so much on the training side of it. He'll be sitting there acting like he's on a machine trying to do cardio, but really he's looking at me like, hurry up, mate. Push the bloody bar so that we can keep up with this bloody recovery side of things. So, yeah, that was a tough period in time for me, like not being able to be doing preseason with the boys, mm-hmm. out on the field with the boys. And so the day that I actually got to run around on the field was like one of my happiest days because I was getting closer and closer to joining the team again.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was a massive battle in my head through those periods of times. And then when I finally started playing rugby, my biggest thing was whether I was confident enough that it wouldn't break again.
Mm.
You know, flashbacks of what happened.
Well, true, we're getting those flashbacks.
Yeah, so, you know, someone will tackle me and I quickly jump just to try not to get caught again and stuff like that. But, you know, it took me a while. I think that whole process helped me realize that, you know, when you've got an injury that's kept you out of the game for so long, you know, you've actually got to make sure that you look after yourself properly.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, not in the sense of like eating, but like in the sense of like actually doing rehab, actually stretching, doing some mobility around the injury so that, you know, it's not stiffening up and that you still got that flexibility that you had beforehand.
Mm.
Just little things like that. So trying to move forward, get myself into a condition where I'm still able to play footy. I'm not quite at my playing weight, but just still having that process to get me to where I need to be by end of like Tri Nations.
Yeah.
That was the process that we had put in place. The All Blacks coaches and the trainers, both the Hurricanes and also Gilly, you know, that helped so much in terms of, you know, okay, if I actually make sure that I spend time and stick to it, they're actually there to support me and they're giving me the confidence that I need that, you know, if you get yourself in a good condition and you can start playing Super Rugby, you know, there's an opportunity there for you. Mm. But, you know, you can't just sit back and wait, you know, and think that it's just going to be there. You've still got to fight to earn that opportunity to be in the team again.
Yeah. Did you think you could do it? Obviously what you'd been through with weren't picked and then going through this, the mental struggles and training by yourself, it's so isolating. Did you feel like you're going to be able to get back to your best and be available?
Oh, I just knew I would definitely be available.
Yeah.
Like I just from conversations with the three wise men, you know, they gave me, I wouldn't say reassurance, but they gave me enough to make me feel like, yes, if I actually put my head down and my ass up and go to work, that spot that I've been fighting for is potentially there.
Mm.
But if you don't work for it, it's not going to be there and we're just, you know, not going to bother with it. But I guess the biggest part was trying to get on the field first and foremost.
Yeah.
I managed to get back to play a few games for Wainui. That's where I was getting a bit scared. you know, I mean, it was wet too, and you're just thinking, oh, someone's actually going to slide underneath me. It's going to happen again, and my dream of, you know, playing in the World Cup's going to be taken away from me once again. But, yeah, I slowly got a bit more confident with it, and then managed to come back, play against the Force, Western Force up in Palmy, and the lungs were freaking screaming. Wasn't so much the rest of the body, but the lungs were screaming like, what are you up to, cuz? So it was awesome just to finally be able to get back on the field, you know, and start playing footy with the boys again. But yeah, it was definitely tough. Like I battled through some demons to get there.
But you got there, and how'd you find out? How'd you find out you were going to the 2011 Rugby World Cup?
Oh, well, because they had obviously the Steinlager series before Tri Nations, and then obviously had the Tri Nations. But because it was such a big year, and we had the earthquake down in Christchurch, so majority of the team that was involved in the Tri Nations, they played the games here in New Zealand. So the Canterbury boys played those games, but we left to go to South Africa, and pretty much all the Canterbury boys stayed home to be with their families.
Oh yeah.
And so we went up there, I wouldn't say with a under strength team, but it wasn't our full team, but we still felt that we could do the job. So we went there, played South Africa, lost to South Africa. And they actually named the squad when we were in South Africa. So all the players knew before everyone else knew when they announced the team. But the distinct part about it was we had to go to Brisbane after that.
Everyone?
Everyone.
Oh, true. So these guys knew and they still had to play a game.
The boys that didn't make the squad had to travel to Australia, to Brisbane. And, you know, basically they had no chance to go home and be with whānau to support them and be there for them, you know, through that period of time. So a few of us decided, you know, they've got no family here. We feel like we're family to them, so we need to be around them to make sure that they're, you know, they know that we're here for you, bro. I know it's a sad time. And so we lost them. Brisbane, you know, for all of us, it's the first time I actually seen Ted throw his toys, bro. Like, especially in the change rooms, I've never seen him throw his toys that bad before. But the way I've seen it is those two losses that we had in Tri Nations actually set us up for the World Cup, because we understood that there's three areas that we need to take care of. To help us have a successful campaign. Obviously, one of them was the mental side of it. That was a huge one. We spent more time focusing on our mental side of the game. The other one is momentum shifts, when the momentum shifts are on the opposition side, and how do we get that back? And then obviously with 2007, they had no one taking a shot at the old drop kick. You know, we actually set ourselves up so that was up our sleeve whenever we needed to pull it out. So leading into the World Cup, I was confident that we were going to win, because I felt that we have focused on three areas that we needed to, and we basically just tried to nail it week in, week out with those three things.
Mate, that's positive news for all All Blacks fans heading into this World Cup too. I forgot that you guys had lost two games going into that World Cup. I just remember you guys being red hot favourites to win it.
Yeah, well, to us, we obviously, you know, being at home, you know, you want to make sure that you get the job done. But I felt we worked hard in those three areas to allow us to get to the big dance. And if we needed to, like, set ourselves up to go for the win, we we done everything possible to give us that chance if we needed to. But, yeah, that was huge learnings for us. That's what I felt anyway. Not only that, those three things, yeah, we done a lot of other things leading up to trainings. We had many group chats, so all the 9s and 10s would get together.
Yeah.
And the best things that we talked about were the what ifs. What if we're losing? What do we do? And like all of us would have our input. Most of it was just, yeah, what he said. But then you try and throw a little ripple in the system. And then the boys look at you, hey, when did we talk about that? Oh no, maybe not this week, maybe next week. But it's the what ifs that helped us understand that, like, if someone or in the team that's important goes down, what do we do next? And obviously with DC done his hip flexor at training before Canada, you know, we didn't actually panic. We knew exactly what we needed to do because we talked about it. That made us understand that, like, okay, he's gone down. Oh, you're going in, you're doing the same role. You know, whatever you need help with, we got your back. If he's not doing something, we'll talk to him about it. I need you to play a bit more down here.
Yeah. How many tens deep was it till you started to think, okay, we're getting low here, or putting your hand up? I know you loved playing 10.
No, I think it didn't matter how many we had. We felt that
could
like
have gone to the well, yeah.
Yeah, I think, you know, with Aaron coming in, him getting injured, Beaver coming in, you know, we basically told Beaver that week, even the same with Crud when he was there, Aaron, we said, look, you just play footy. We got you. Mm. We just want you to, you know, if you need to put us in the right end of the field, you know, these are the comms so that everyone's on the same page. But we just want you to go out there and play footy, and we can run the team if you want. But if you want to run this team with us, let's go. And so it didn't matter who we had. I think we done the homework and we put on all the hours we needed to execute a game plan to win. Whether we were 7 points down, 12 points down, we still knew that we could execute the game plan if we really needed to. We probably shouldn't have, you know, gave everyone a heart attack and finished with 8-7 in the final. But I think for us, you know, it wasn't just a relief. It was more the fact that we practiced everything that we wanted to execute. Obviously, we seen it in the Australian game in the semi where Aaron Cruden did the droppy. You know, we talked about getting that whenever we needed that, and we could have executed that in the final at some stage. But not only that, leading into Argentina, those momentum shifts, we understood, like, you know, we need to make sure that we're in control. If we start losing control and there's a flow-on effect where we're losing the momentum, where it's a drop ball, penalty, lose a line out, lose a scrum. Mm. You know, we need to go back to basics and figure out, okay, this is what we've got to do now. Everyone needs to calm down, get ourselves back into the now, execute this, finish with that. So we had a lot of processes mapped out before we even got to World Cup, which helped us immensely to get the job done.
Yeah, and you obviously did. And how do you feel about the whole movement of keep calm, putties on? Obviously started after the 7-from-7 penalties against Argentina in the quarterfinal, where obviously Carter had gone down, needed a kicker to step up. You step up. How are you feeling going into that game, being a goal kicker with literally the country on your shoulder?
Oh, see, I don't know. I'm probably a bit different to Slady and also to Dizzy. With kicking, you either get it or you don't. And if you don't, shit happens. You just got to get on with it and play footy. Yeah. I guess I was just lucky that, you know, the practice that I had done, which was none during the week. Like, I never practice my kicks because I learnt through Mick Byrne that if the ball flies in a certain way, that's not my natural flight. then I've done something wrong in it, and I need to figure out what it is. So I figured out what a perfect kick looked like for me and felt like, and then anything after that, if it didn't feel like that, I had done something wrong. So come quarter final time, I didn't practice kicking that week. I only practiced in the warm-up.
That's crazy.
Like, I did my warm-up, practiced my kicks, and just all I was looking for was just, if I was on the right-hand side, how the ball was flying.
Yeah.
And if there was any wind there, you know, how hard it was pushing it across the post.
Yeah.
Go to the left-hand side, get a feel of the exact same thing, sort of a little bit to the sides, and see what, you know, what I've got to do, as long as I'm sticking to my process and just kicking through rather than, because I know sometimes when it's an easy kick, you know, some kickers just actually think, oh yeah, I'll just tap this over.
Yeah.
But if you don't follow through with your whole process, you know, it's, it can actually jeopardize the flight of everything.
Yeah.
So just trying to get a feel of it. And then when I'm like, I did maybe one or two on the 40, just to see, you know, the further out, if it flies differently when I'm trying to kick through it. But yeah, that's all down to Mick Byrne about, you know, teaching us the mechanic, well, teaching me the mechanics of kicking, whether it's box kicking, kicking out of the hand, place kicking, drop kicks, you know, learning everything through him, who's an ex-AFL player.
Yeah.
You know, some of the skills that he taught us, I'm thinking, are you sure you didn't play league or rugby, cubs? Because, like, I don't think I've seen any of these bloody drills or these skills by anyone else. And you're an AFL player. So, you know, this is, like, to me, I was mind-blown that someone, a legend of the AFL, comes and he's a kicking coach for us. But not only that, he's, like, teaching us all about, like, punching the ball, you know, rather than trying to reload and things like that. So
all the
mechanics of like kicking through Mick, you know, I wouldn't say I didn't have to practice, but like if anything I needed to keep practicing was around my general play kick, box kicking, but goal kicking I didn't need to practice that, because through Mick I pretty much understood.
Mate, you make it sound so easy.
It is once you understand. Like, it's bizarre. I mean, I watched Jimmy Gopith a few times at Rugby League Park, and you know, Jimmy's a great kicker, and just the battles he was having with himself, you know, and just swearing at the ball, like, or the goalpost, and I'm like, pretty sure they've been stuck there the whole time, my bro. It's me looking from afar going, bro, why are you getting angry at that? Like, you shouldn't be practicing, because you come to game day and you start and you're kicking exactly how you were at training. That's just going to eat into your mindset or your thing. Oh my God, I missed that one. Why did I miss that one? Oh my gosh, I need to move on. But you know, and so I used to that watching him do that a few times. I'm just like, you know what? Nah, I need to come up with something, because I don't want to have that where I'm thinking too much about kicking a ball between two bloody sticks.
Yeah. You obviously passed it on to him, though. He's one of the most successful kickers in the Premiership history.
Oh, nah, Jimmy's bloody, he's always been pretty hard out when it comes to, like, kicking in general.
Yeah.
He put a lot of time into it, so. But, he's 40 this year.
Yeah, still going strong.
Yeah, and still running around in front. Yeah,
incredible, eh?
Living the dream. Oh. Surprised he hasn't pulled out the old golf clubs yet. Oh, actually, I think you might have seen him pull it out.
True.
Bit cold over there to do surfing, though.
Yeah, especially in the winter. Yeah, for sure. Well, what a World Cup. And obviously, once you'd won it, the final, Beavers kick. I think, why weren't you kicking that? You'd missed a couple that game and came off injured as well.
I strained my groin in the warm-up.
Oh, did you?
Yeah. I actually... Wow.
Another one. What was with the groins? Was this kicking?
Well, after the quarterfinal, I actually done an extra practice. Like, I had gone to, but the hardest
what you just told us.
Nah, yeah, I know, but there's a reason why though. Like, Smithy gave me this look of like, well, you better be taking this bloody serious or I'm going to freaking leave you on the bench and I'll get someone else to do this that may take this seriously. But, like, yeah, I was – he gave me – as soon as he gave me that look, I knew that look straight away. I was like, "Fuck, man.
Yeah.
Just let me do my thing. Like, don't put pressure on me to practice." And so I done a kicking session the day before the semifinal. And shanked a few, kicked a few, and then did the same thing the week after. I knew it was a bit tight, but just thought, you know, we'll get through the week. Got to captain's run. He's look, giving me the look again. I'm like, really? You really want me to? So I practiced at captain's run and then started warming up in the final and going through my routine. And I think I might have been only about kick number four in my in my kicking routine, and I just looked at Mick and was like, "Bro, something's not feeling right here," because I kept pulling it to the left. It's because I wasn't feeling comfortable in my follow through.
True.
And so I basically told the physios, we went inside, I don't know what the hell they were going to do to try and save me to play. But yeah, I tweaked my groin. And the two kicks that I, like Woody's try and the penalty that I missed, both times I was trying to figure out, you know, just kick through, like bite down on that gum shield, son, and freaking hope for the best. But just as you go to approach, you know, that backswing and then the follow coming through, you felt it as soon as you bloody planted your foot. You're like, oh, this isn't going to be nice.
Yeah.
So you just pull out just because you don't want to pull it, like, how bloody busy and Slady did it. So that's the reason why I didn't kick so well in that final. And even at halftime, I ran to Mick and said, "Nah, Beaver needs to kick, bro. Like, I can hardly freaking kick, let alone run around." So
that's crazy.
So we got together, and him and I basically said to Beaver, "Look, you've got to kick, bro. You all goods to kick goals?" And Beaver's like, "Yeah, all goods." And so Beaver stepped up and slotted it.
Now there's a movie on him.
He actually, when he kicked it, I knew it went straight between the sticks, but Richie was telling him that he thought he missed it. And Beaver's confidence, nah, bro.
He turned early. He was
confident. And then I remember running back to him, and I'm like looking at Beaver like, "Bro, sort your jersey out, cuss." Pulling it down all the time.
Oh, so good, Ace. Oh, good memories of the World Cup. One thing I do want to talk to you about, though, is your Hurricanes time. I think it was the same year, 2011. You leave the Hurricanes. Keen to hear around the conversations around that, because obviously Hurricane legend. What happened there?
We had obviously new coach. And obviously all the leaders.
You were in the leadership group?
Kind of, but not sort of hard out like Rory and Co. But because I'd obviously been there since 2004 and, you know, obviously been around for quite some time. Got together with the head coach and, you know, just basically said, "Look, don't try and turn this into the Crusaders, because we're not." You know, bring some keep the fear that we've got, but, you know, there definitely is some areas that we need to work on. And if you could bring that and give us the edge around it, I think, you know, everything should be sweet. But obviously, you know, it's a little bit like Uncle Jamie Joe, his way or the highway type old school mentality.
Yeah.
And yeah, sort of a few boys butted heads with him because, you know, all we're trying to do is continue with what we've been doing, but we understood the areas that needed to change and to try and turn us into a team that we're not, rather than just working with the cattle that you've got, and understanding the cattle that you've got, and nurturing that and trying to make it a little bit better, give it a bit more edge to it, and make sure that you understand the areas that aren't so great within the team structure. Mm-hmm. It was a tough one. All my mates, all the senior boys were pretty much getting pushed out, and I had a chance to sort of stay or go. And I read an article, him saying that I left to go to the Blues because of the money. But I got offered more to stay at the Hurricanes.
Oh, really?
It had nothing to do with money. Mine was more environment in terms of, like, you know, keeping the same sort of culture that we've had, but not trying to change it too much, you know. Still want to keep that structure that we've always had as the Hurricanes. They'll predict the unpredictable, I think it was, or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, try and continue to keep that, but still have something that other teams haven't seen us do, which was obviously the biggest one, was the breakdown. Mm. Being absolute menaces in the breakdown. That's what the Crusaders have been dominant over the years, is all that ugly hard work that those boys, you know, like, especially that pack. No matter what pack they had a pack that would always, guys knew what their roles were. If your role was to hit rucks, you hit rucks. And you're a beast at hitting rucks, you know. We probably lacked a little bit and just relied on a couple of boys to do those roles when, in fact, everyone needed to roll the old sleeves up and go to mahi. But, it had nothing to do with money. Mine was more culture, and the way that I saw it wasn't quite the culture that I wanted to be involved with, because it was changing dramatically. That's why I decided to move away and go to Auckland. And it was a tough one because, you know, I didn't really want to leave. Wanted to do was just say.
Yeah. Was there pressure from some of the boys to get you to stay? Were some of them saying, come, nah, please, like, stay? And some, obviously, who had left, was there pressure on them for you to leave as well? Like, were you sort of stuck in the middle a little bit?
I wouldn't say I was stuck in the middle. I think, like, Bodie rang me out of the blue too, and I was like, hey, whose number's this? Because, you know, obviously, I don't know that the young fella. 19. Yeah. I don't know the young fella was, you know, coming down. And I was just like, oh, yeah. I'm going to think about this one. Bro, but you know, obviously the likes of TJ was coming through, in terms of wanting to continue being a dominant force that he has been. Had JGP, who's now with Ireland, Jamison Gibson Park. You know, he was nipping at my heels, and so I thought, you know what, I'll be keen to try a different culture and see what I can achieve with it. Wasn't the greatest in 12, sorry, but definitely some big improvements after that from moving forward in 2013 and that. So yeah, the biggest reason was I could see that the culture and the way that they were moving wasn't quite the one that I was thinking it would be, so I thought I'd, you know, have a bit of a change and see what it was like.
Yeah, and how'd you find the culture up there in Auckland?
Different. Oh, yeah, the big fucking lights of Auckland, the big smoke. We had a coffee machine and a barista. I'm like, oh, this is the next level, just to have a coffee at your bloody at mahi. Just go to the cafe and get one, cuz. But yeah, just things like that. But other than that, like, learning who my new teammates are, even though we played against them, played side by side with some of them, and I just seen it as an opportunity just to try and start fresh. It wasn't easy though. Like, obviously, every season, everyone's slagging me around the media, around my weight and stuff like that. So, end of 2011, I almost lost my father. And so rather than me training, I was at the hospital. We were sleeping on the floor just so that we could be next to Dad, who was in ICU. And I come close to not going to Auckland because I wanted to be there for my dad.
Yeah.
Just in case, you know, if anything happened, I was there. And so definitely had no desire to train. All I wanted to do was just, be there. So I just sat there waiting. Sometimes we weren't doing anything. We just sat there waiting, helping out the nurses and stuff like that to help roll our dad, to basically, you know, tidy him up and make sure he's nice and fresh so that he's not sort of like, I think they get, because they're in the comas and stuff like that, sometimes they get sores and things like that.
Yeah.
So we tried to make sure that we helped him out because he wasn't the skinniest man to bloody lift as a nurse. So our family was always there trying to help out where we could. So when I did finally leave and move to Auckland, you know, I wasn't in great nick, but I always knew that, like, if there's a goal that you want me to get to, I'll bust my ass to get to it.
Yeah.
So there was always a big goal, a medium goal, and a little goal when it comes to trying to drop the weight, just so I could be running around with the boys. It was a lot of things happened in the background with in our first season up there. But other than that, I enjoyed my time in my first year at the Blues and then also with Auckland. In the second year, obviously, JK had just been announced as our new head coach at the Blues. And I didn't think we didn't lose too many players from the year before. So, you know, it was a rebuilding phase and slowly sort of understanding all the young talent that was coming through and how much potential and talent they had. The likes of like Frank Halai, George Moala, Charles Pietau, Peter Saeli, Pita Aki, you know, those boys, kids coming into an environment like that. So my hat started changing after that in terms of, okay, if I'm going to be a leader to help these kids come through, I need to be in better shape. So 2013, I was in pretty good, like close to, I was pretty much near my playing weight. And it was the first time I had a preseason.
True, full preseason. Yeah,
in a long time. Long preseason. Oh, so,
you loved it.
Oh, I think I missed, there's a couple of sessions that I missed. Sand Dunes was one of them. I wasn't there. And then they tactical. Went up. Yeah. Very tactical. But I mean, like, in terms of the rebuild, you know.
Yeah.
Trying to help nurture those boys and get them to understand. Yeah. You know, the weird thing about footy now, everyone's talking about rugby dying. And there's a massive reason why. It's because I wouldn't say it's just because of the Auckland schools, but these kids are getting scouted at college. And then they go from college and going straight into a professional environment. But they don't know how to play footy. You know, they haven't played one season in grassroots rugby at club level, where I learnt my craft through all the old heads, the 100 cappers, the 200 cappers, from the club, listen to the stories in the club and from all the old timers about their days in the jersey. And it's just like, you know, these kids go to school and go straight into a professional environment. They haven't learnt the art of actually playing footy. And especially in their role as a 9, a 10, or even a prop, you know. So, yeah.
That's a good point.
Trying to help them out coming from college straight into Super Rugby and even NPC. you know, you're just trying to give them as much advice as possible around, mm-hmm. you know, seeing different pictures and understanding what pictures look like, shapes that people present, so that you can turn them inside out, break their ankles, you know, just little cues like that to help them understand, rather, because I have a feeling some of these kids these days, like, because they've been taught throughout their career, this is how you do this, 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 and that.
So strict.
They get all the way to professional, and then they're like, there's no instinct. They don't know how to play a heads up footy. Like, there's opportunities to play, like, behind a pod, and then you shift it to an edge. But they just, you carry.
Yeah.
You carry. And then, they're standing there waiting, so when are we going to have a go?
Yeah.
You know, I find watching some of the footy a little bit robotic.
Oh, massively. And you were such an instinctive player yourself as well. You played a lot off feel, and you were just like a natural baller when you must see these guys who, like you say, so structured now at such a young age that they're not looking for the space. They're just sort of looking for their own team shape, not what's actually in front of them.
Oh, exactly. But I think probably back then when I was a kid coming up, you know, I played every sport there was.
Yeah.
You get to college and they're pretty much telling you, no, you can only play rugby. You can't play basketball. You can't go play volleyball. Just in case you get injured, I'm like, right, if you want to go and play any other sport at the same time and you don't get injured, bro, I'm all for it.
Yeah.
You know, you've got to learn how to read scenarios different. So you transfer that from one game into another. Okay. I saw him do that. Oh, actually, I can see him do that. Yeah. Show me a different picture to, you know.
How much of that did you do in your rugby career? How much league did you sneak off and play? I've heard rumours that you used to sneak off the odd Sunday and play, even when you're at the Canes and All Blacks, etc.
Oh, those were my early days. I used to put a headgear on, try and hide, use my middle name.
Oh, true.
Encouraged by my father sometimes too. but I would never play sort of premier. I would always go and play reserve game.
Oh, yeah, and just carve up.
Oh, nah, I just wanted to be sort of out there, and, you know, I found the development with it because they presented pictures that are different to some of the pictures you see in a rugby field.
Yeah.
With body shape and body language of individuals. And, you know, with league, some of them as defenders aren't great defenders when you've got to move them.
Mm.
When they're lateral, they're not used to it because they're all used to you running straight at them.
Yeah.
And that's why you see so much massive hits, because, you know, they're trying to actually run for a brick wall and they're getting absolutely folded. But then when you actually see some of the forwards, you know, starting to ball play, throwing a front door, back door, putting their own teammates into space, and, you know, then you've got forwards running good, hard lines to either hold defenders, or if they don't bite, then you're just putting them into holes. So all that kind of stuff I thoroughly enjoyed.
Mate, you love league, don't you?
I do.
Look how excited you're getting.
I've been coaching my daughter's league team.
Oh, that's good stuff. And one thing that happened at the Blues, I think it happened at the Blues, but did you have a stroke at the Blues?
Yeah, I did.
Talk me through that. Like, that's a pretty unusual situation for a professional footy player. Like, obviously, it must have shocked you.
Yeah, so we were at recovery, and I was in the pool doing a few lengths. There was me, Peter Saley, I think it was George Moyler, and Charles Piatow. And well, obviously recovery, you do all your lengths, you're swimming, you're walking, you're stretching. And we were just doing, walking up and down the pool during our lengths, and all of a sudden, like, mid-conversation, I was just, you know, they asked me a question. I'm like, yeah, no. And I'm like, in my head, I thought, hang on, what's happening here? Did I just mumble something and not open my mouth? But in my head I thought, yo, this is what I said. So I was so I was like kind of just, I wouldn't say, but talking like a baby.
But you didn't know you were talking like a baby.
Nah. Well, I did, but in my head I thought I was, you know, I knew what I was saying.
Yeah.
So I got frustrated, jumped out of the pool, got changed, and then went to walk out, and Benji was trying to get my attention because he wanted my goggles. And, like, he was literally here, and then I was like, oh, were you trying to get my attention? He goes, yes. So, oh, okay, what do you want? Your goggles on. My bad. So I walked out, still frustrated, jumped in the car, and I sat there, and I'm like, what is going on here? So I started up the car. I drove 50 meters because my vision was getting blurry. And in my head, I'm thinking, wait, what's going on? So I was rubbing my eyes, squinting, like, hey, what's going on here? I'm just grateful that I was like about 3 Ks up the road, 4 Ks up the road to my house. Drove slowly, got home safely, and then went inside and just sat in. I remember trying to text our team doctor to say help. And I couldn't even text him. Fire. So I ended up doing the old, I thought, you know what, maybe I just need to have a nap. So I tried to set my alarm, clearly wasn't functional, so I was just like, oh, you know, whatever. So I had a bit of a sleep, woke up, had a little bit of a speech in me, and asked my cousin to take me to the team doctor. I need to go and see the team doctor. She drove me there. He wasn't there, so I gave him my phone and said, ring the doctor. We were actually traveling to South Africa that afternoon. And so I hadn't packed my bag, and ended up sort of panicking a bit, like, hey, what the hell is going on?
Did you have any idea what it could be? What?
No. Well, I thought it might have been the late concussion from the game the night before.
Yeah.
Because I remember getting a bit of a head clash with, I don't know if it was Rita or Flinny, but I just thought, okay, maybe it was that. And that's like super delayed. But I remember going to our team doctor's house, and he was talking about, you know, he said delayed concussion too, maybe dehydration. I'm thinking, well, I didn't do anything last night, so how can I be dehydrated? I just peeled back a couple of those Powerades and, you know, let me run into the funny bucket after that.
Massive dehydration symptoms.
Yeah, hard. And then his last one, he said, stroke. And in my head, I was like, are you serious? Well, thinking this potentially could be a stroke. Well, anyway, we jumped on the plane to South Africa, went to Aussie, flew to South Africa, got to our team training, our first team training the next day, and I started feeling real pale. Like, even he looked at me and was like, oh, sheesh, you're like white as.
Sure.
And I'm thinking, hey. So I had to sit down and sit out training for the rest of the day. And I noticed that, like, I was struggling to retain our team patterns that week.
Mm.
Like, in my head, I'm thinking, I know this is like bread and butter for me. Why am I struggling to understand what's going on here? And so, yeah, it was bizarre. We were away for 2 weeks, come home, and I knew something was up. So I asked if we could go and get some scans done. And, yeah, we got a few scans done a few tests, and found out that there was a hole in my heart.
All right. You obviously didn't play while you're away. Were you just...
No, I played a couple games.
You played with it? Oh, far out.
Yeah, I played.
Is that dangerous or no?
How would I know? I'm assuming if you do, you know what it is right from the get-go, yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely. But if you have no understanding of it being an actual stroke at the time, just to continue and go. But, yeah, we were playing. We come home, and I was like, nah, man. I said to the doc, look, we've got to go and get some tests done. something's playing up. I've honestly have no idea, but I know there's something wrong with me. So yeah, had a couple of scans, done a couple of tests, and found that there's a hole in my heart. Everyone's born with it, but no one knows whether it's closed or not. So they did this bubble test,
okay.
Where they put, I don't know if it's dye or something, but they can scan the ticker at the same time. And if there's bubbles that go on the other side of the heart, that's how they find out whether you've got a hole and if your hole hasn't closed or not.
Oh, hell.
But the procedure to close the hole was like 5 minutes. They literally put a slit in my main artery in my hip, put a line all the way up to the old ticker,
yeah.
And basically got to the position that they needed to put this little cuff link, so to speak, the way that he explained it, it's like a cuff link. Put it one side out, open it up, pull it tied up against where the hole is, make sure it's sitting right, and then they push out the other part of the cuff link, twist it off, and then pull the done.
Good to go.
Yeah, but I was lying on the table just looking at it. You can see this.
Oh, you're awake.
I was awake, bro.
Oh, yuck.
I know, exactly. He's already made the slit, and you're looking at these monitors while you're lying down like this. You're like, oh man, look at that. That's pretty cool. Looking at this going all the way to my heart, and I go, oh. Oh, are you doing that? Are you? Oh my gosh, are you in my heart?
Was it a massive ticker?
Nah. Honestly, it was freaky. But then after that, once he unclipped it all at the end and then just pulled the other thing, sewed it back up, and I was gone.
Far out, man. That is crazy.
Oh no. And so.
And then you're good. Like, no issues after that. Like.
No, well, I haven't.
Straight back into it.
I had 2 weeks after that, 2 or 3 weeks, and then I was able to get back out on the field.
Far out, man. That is one of the craziest yarns ever.
I know. I said to them, how long's the recovery? Straight away, how long's the recovery? I don't want to be out for the rest of the season, guys.
And then you sign over in the UK, so with London Welsh, wasn't it, initially?
Yeah.
What was the reason behind that one?
I actually wanted to go and experience what the footy was like over that side of the world.
Oh, yeah.
See what the premiership was like.
London Welsh were in the premiership at the time?
They just got promoted.
Yeah, oh, okay.
But I played in we had a World Teens comp, and the coach was there. So London Welsh was there, and I had a yarn to the coach, and he wanted to know how the old ticket was. Yeah, no, all good, cuz. All good. And then, he got in contact with my agent, and we just kept in contact until, I guess, it was time for me to put pen to paper and see what it was going to be like. So it was a new sort of experience. Obviously, they love their forwards over there in terms of smash and bash and
different style for you spoke about. Yeah, playing instinctively, like that's your game. What, not so much over there, especially back then.
No, exactly. If you don't have a good pack, that's sort of, you know, to be dominant in set piece in the field, it makes things a lot harder. But we had some legends in our team that play for England. Tommy May, Ollie Barkley, just a couple of the boys to name, and we even had a couple of Welsh internationals. So it was, it was an all right team, but just she was a bit of a drive to get to our home game, so down to Oxford from Richmond. So that was a new experience, but my time spent there was awesome. Like I just enjoyed the whole journey. I was still bloody doing the extras with a couple of the boys there that had played Super Rugby that moved over there, like my flatmate was Lockie McCaffrey, who played for the Brumbies, the Tars.
Oh, true.
And so he actually made contact with me to see if I was keen to be flatmates. So I was like, and he was already there, so I was like, yeah, bro, find us a pad, and yeah. Mm. So it was good. Made some good mates over there.
And,
it was a totally different competition than I'm used to. Mm. I think I still would have preferred Super Rugby just in terms of just the constant battles that you have trying to play chess, and, you know, if you don't get it right and you put too much of your bloody your big guns in there, you're going to lose your game. But over there, you just mash and bash and make sure that you can last for 80 minutes. And if your team's not up to it, you usually get found out.
Yeah. And you went through four clubs in pretty quick succession too, eh? Like, I think all those contracts were terminated by you, I think. So what was the sort of reason behind it? Were you just not enjoying it, or?
No, I got actually loaned out to Wasps.
Well, did you get loaned from London Welsh to Wasps?
Yeah, it was a real weird one, because I didn't want to go, because, you know, my biggest thing was I got asked to go play for London Welsh, and I wanted to stay there with the coach.
Yeah.
Just because he brought me over and things like that. But he was like, nah, you should go. And I'm like, looking at him going, cuz.
Thought we're in this together.
Well, hard. You're telling me to go to bloody Wasps. So I played a handful of games for Wasps, and it was definitely totally different to London Welsh. Mm. In terms of the setup and stuff like that. But, you know, they obviously brought, or their owner at the time, brought the stadium out in Coventry.
Yeah.
And had all these massive ideas. And I was thinking, wow, is he really that loaded?
Obviously not.
Yeah, I think he might have just got a bit trigger happy on the market. But, yeah, it was sort of eye-opener. Mm. After the season finished, I went straight back to hang out with the London Welsh boys, because, you know,
yeah.
I didn't really want to go to Wasp. I only went there just because, you know, the coach said that it would be a good opportunity for me. Yeah. So went from London Welsh to Wasp, and then got an opportunity to go and play in France. Mm. And Oyonnax.
That's one of the ones I was trying to – it's a hard one, eh? You read it and you're like, wow, this could be pronounced so many different ways.
Yeah, Oyonnax is usually one of them.
Yeah, I would have definitely said the X. And what was the other one?
Narbonne.
I went to Narbonne. Okay, silent. Narbonne. So how'd you find it in France?
Love the lifestyle. Yeah. The lifestyle was awesome. And just the French culture.
Yeah.
Wasn't a massive fan of the footy. Well, not the footy was fine. I think it was more the mentality.
Yeah.
You know, they do, like, you'll get, like, for my short period of time there, you're guaranteed to win home games.
Mm.
And then you send the academy team with a couple of internationals to the away games, and you pretty much get slapped. And I just couldn't quite understand it, that we've been driven to be winners week in, week out, not win 1 week, have a break 1 week, go back to being winners again. You just want to be competitive week in, week out. And so that whole mentality for me was, like, it was a bizarre one. I couldn't understand it. Yeah. And, you know, some of the standards there weren't high.
Yeah.
And like, I remember one training session, I had enough that the boys just thought it was a joke. You know, they couldn't even string a couple of phases together, and we just continued it, and it was like, oh.
What did you do?
I just walked off.
Oh, did you?
Yeah. It's like you're trying to continue with something that's just not going to be good. So I just walked off, just needed to sort of, like, have a bit of a breath, take a break, and then go. And then I ended up walking back out.
Oh, okay.
But I was sort of just, I needed.
But you're straight on the plane, Victor.
Nah, bro. I just, because I wanted to be, you know, a leader there to help the club, like, you know, to be successful. But when, you're trying to be successful and the team's standards aren't at a higher level, you're not going to reach the potential that that you should. So for me, it was, you know, if we can have our standards high here and try and maintain that throughout the course of our campaign or our season, you know, we should be able to compete week in, week out. But when your standards are here on home games and in away games they're down here, you know, it's just not a – it just didn't sit well, that's all.
Plus,
I lost the lame love for the game over there just because of all that kind of stuff. Yeah. I don't think it mattered whether I was at a top team or not, because you look at the competition and all the top teams won home games and they target some of the teams that are sitting at the bottom of the table.
Yeah.
Because those are the ones that they actually need to win just so that they can stay in the top six.
Yeah.
So to speak. And then, you know, they've done their job. So.
So is that why you moved back to Wairarapa Bush? To get some love for the game back?
Oh, I actually just moved home and just missed being around whānau.
Yeah. Well, so you're pretty much, in your mind, had you finished playing footy?
Pretty much.
Oh, really? Oh, okay.
It was just my cousin. My cousin kept hounding me. Because I was training with my cousin Damon.
Yeah.
And he was just like, I'm training for the Bush. Come, you should come and play for them. And I was like, nah, I'm all good. It's like, I don't mind just training. Like, I was training four times a week with him. Obviously, he had no bloody job. I didn't know what I wanted to do next. And I buckled and decided, okay, well, I might need to lose a few kilos to actually start playing again. Mm. And went over there. Oh, actually, the coaching staff all came over to meet me and, you know, basically thing they asked, well, what do you want? I said, well, I'm not here for the freaking money, cuz. Otherwise, I wouldn't have said yes. But what I do want is a vehicle with petrol vouchers so that, because there was about four or five of us that were travelling over.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I said, as long as we can get a vehicle to go backwards and forwards and that the tank's sweet, then that's all I want. They did give us match fees and stuff like that, but I said, look, I'm not here for the money. You can either keep that money or give it to a charity of your guys' choice.
Oh, what a lad.
And I just want to play footy. Bro, I swear, the first two sessions, I started like, oh, my God, this is why I love the game.
Really, yeah.
Like, those boys over that side, farmers, tradies, they're up early hours of the morning, grinding away on the farms and, you know, whatever trade that they're in, come to footy at night, still got so much energy, and they're around, you know, hardly getting paid for whatever they're, you know, for showing up. Well, they just love footy.
Yeah.
And those first two sessions, watching the boys, I was just like, yo, you know what? Yeah, I'll play.
That's
I want to play. And then by the end of the season, I totally fell in love with footy again and felt that that was the right time to hang up the boots. So, yeah, even though I didn't play the last game, through injury, but, you know, just to actually fall in love with the game again was huge for me, and it was a sign that, you know, maybe now's the time to close that chapter.
Oh, what a cool way to do it. And you spoke about injury. Like, how is your body now? Is your body sweet?
Oh, yeah, nah. Yeah, nah. I've got arthritis in both my ankles. So, like, sometimes I can hardly run around. I've been trying to run around with my first 15 boys at training, and like, yeah, just can hardly move. My right knee's bone on bone, so when it's a cold morning, she's slow to get up and get moving. So,
oh, hell.
But other than that, like everything else is fine. But it's mostly
other than my knees and ankles.
Yeah, I'm good to the go. Main ones to help you move from A to B. Trying to bloody run races with your kids and thinking that you still got it, and then they run past you like, no, that's it. No, we're going to be. Oh, we'll have another race soon. Not right now, but look out.
Yeah. So how hard did you find that transition? Obviously, you picked up your TV show. We've spoken about that. But the transition to go from not playing to finding that new identity?
Oh, bro, it was tough. Like, I'm not going to lie. It was tough. I was at home doing nothing, sleep most of the day. Like, what the hell are you up to, bro? And then obviously got the opportunity to be the presenter for my TV series.
Yeah.
Not only that, I picked up a few gigs for commentating as well. And it wasn't until possibly this year, actually, that I've actually got my first real job. I'm actually a mentor at Wellington College.
Oh, true.
Helping out the meant to be the Māori students, but the way I see it is, you know, I'm there. If I'm there, I'm there for all those students. If they need someone to talk to, my door's always. If I'm in my office, you know. Few of the boys start coming in now because they've gotten comfortable with me. So, oh, organs, if I just chill out in here. Have you got class? No? Oh, yucky. But I've been enjoying that.
That's cool.
Even like earlier this year when I first started my role at the college and I had to shoot off to go and do filming, I was like, can we speed this up? They're like, hey, what do you mean? I was like, I'm kind of missing my job. You know, it's actually... Some like I actually had a purpose.
Yeah,
you know when you go from rugby where, you've got that throughout your career, but you know you're actually working on your craft, and then once the boots and the lights and all that are gone, you got to try and figure out, you know, what's your purpose in life after that. Mm. What's something that you're going to love doing, you know, and that you're going to enjoy doing. On a daily day basis. Like I said this at a speaking engagement last night that, you know, after footy, I don't want to be going to someone's work and ruining their business.
Yeah.
Because I'm not sort of invested in it. I don't love it. You know, if I'm going to do something, I want to be, it's a job that I love doing, that I'm driven to help be successful, whether it's me or the people that are around me to be successful. You know, things like that, as opposed to rocking up in the morning with a shit attitude.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't want to be here, bro. Yeah. I'm just going to be an asshole today.
Yeah.
So with my role that I have now, I mean, honestly, I'm absolutely loving it of, you know, trying to help mentor groups of students, individuals, and, you know, trying to help them. But it's weird because, yes, their teen students get to have to leave the school ground, so you're trying to help them prepare for the big bad world, you know. And it's like, well, funny, I'm just finished that, and I'm just finally found me something to
We're
do
in it together.
So come on, let me try and help you figure this all out. You know, I mean, school's not for everyone, but you know, the students that are there. You know, you want to try and help give them opportunities and, you know, try and constantly check up on them to make sure that they've still got their plan, they're still working to execute it. So, yeah, this year's been awesome in terms of, you know, nailing a job and loving it as well. And, you know, all the staff that I'm working with at Wellington College have been awesome. We've got our headmaster is awesome, Glenn Denham. He used to be at Massey. He's a ex-captain of the Tour Blacks. Oh, so if you need someone to actually get the team up, he's not shy of a few good words and inspirational chats. So, you know, it's the way that he sort of speaks as well. It's like infectious because he's actually caring about trying to get these kids set up so that when they walk out the gates for the last time, you know, they've got a plan in place to help them success, be successful in life. Mm. So, yeah, it's honestly, it's been freaking, been an awesome year being a mentor at the school and, you know, trying to be organized and help things out there. And on top of that, coach the many codes of sports on the way.
Mate, sounds like all good stuff, and no doubt Wellington College are in good hands. After listening to you here, man, you'd be absolute perfect mentor for any young kid going through school. But as always, we have gone to our Instagram for some questions. Conscious of the time, we had thousands come in. I'll narrow it down to sort of the top three or four. First question was, what did his props do to him when he was the Hurricanes under 18 captain?
Oh, that's John Schroger. I know that for a fact. So, we're at, was it Linton Army Camp, I think, in Palmerston North, and we got together as a squad, and he knew that I was a Wellington boy, but because I went to Te Aute, played for Hawke's Bay, he said to me, "Nah, you're Hawke's Bay." I was like, "Shut up, you know exactly where I'm from. I'm a Wellington boy." So basically they got me into a room. There was about seven of the Wellington boys in there. Anthony Piranese was in there too. And I was like, okay. So they basically said to me, "Number one or number two?" And in my head I'm thinking, "Are we going to toilet here?" Or, you know. But there was definitely no bathroom in the room there. But they said, "Nah." I said, "Well, what's number one?" They said, "Well, you can fight your way out of this." And I said, "Well, what's number two?" And they said, "Well, we'll strap you to that chair right over there, and you can stay there." I was like, "Oh well, looks like it's going to be number one." Had a couple of props in my team that were in their bloody room, so I knew I was going to be screwed no matter what. And so they basically strapped me to the chair, and left me there for a bit, and it was funny because they did the exact same thing to Glenn Horden.
Oh, yeah.
And old Hortz basically said number two right from the get-go. He didn't even try and put up a fight. I still give him shit about that. So that's what happened when we were in camp. Being the captain, you would have thought, surely I get a pass.
Bit more respect, eh?
No, it wasn't to be. It wasn't to be.
Oh, cracker. Okay, next one. What was the inspiration behind the two blonde patches in your hair? Was it two? I always only remember one sort of at the front.
Yeah, there was one at the back too.
One at the back, yeah.
I don't know. Just something different, I think. I had done bleaching my bloody hair. Some of those didn't turn out the greatest. I think one year I was rocking bloody the old orange mop. Yeah, when we started thing, Namir, myself, and Ma'a thought we'd try and start a new trend and get the old blotch of blonde there. And I put one down the back. Ma'a only had his at the front. So Ma'a actually cut a couple of his dreads off so that he could actually grow a bit of hair and have a little bit of a mohawk but still be able to put the blonde patch in there.
Oh, bring it back.
Bro, I think I've still got a patch. Where my greys are now is where the bloody patch was. But it was just something different. The other one I was going to do, but Matt Gitter had done it, was I was going to try and do the old cross.
Oh, yeah.
Strip, but then I saw him do it, and I'm like, we'll just stick with the patches.
Okay, next one. What do you remember about the Robbie Fruin Fend?
I actually thought that he was not my man. I was backpedaling thinking that. I think it might have been Bain and Kura might have been inside me. And I thought, like in my head, I was thinking, that's not my man. And then looked up, he was coming at me. So I thought, oh, this isn't going to be pleasant.
He was thinking, you are his man.
Yeah, hard. So I just, I just got put on my ass.
Yeah, that's it. That's all you remember.
Oh, pretty much. Oh, no. I remember getting up. and saying to the boys, because the boys used to give me shit about it, and I'm like, yeah, all good. But did you see what happened after? All you guys saw was me getting bumped off, but there was actually helped get a turnover there by everyone being distracted because I got bumped off, and we turned the ball over, and I started started rucking Robbie. But I kid you not, we had a camp earlier this year for our rugby boys, and we had like a kind of like a quiz night, and that showed up. They Phil actually put that clip up, and I was like, don't worry about that. Worry about like what happened next. He showed what happened next, and they were all like, "Hey, what the hell are you doing there?" I said, "You don't know nothing about rucking, boys. You don't want to know what that is all about." I think I still might have a few scars from all the rucks that I got from my career. Jesus, imagine if that was still going these days, rucking.
Oh, imagine it, eh? Brutal.
Jeez. You probably would have got it. Oh, no, you wouldn't have had a few, would you, Jimmy?
I was at the very end of it. It just sort of come out, but in the club footy scene, that was
That was their favourite thing to do, wasn't it? Not even by the ball.
Young kid out of school.
Yeah, exactly. You got the old massive scars like someone's bloody whooped you.
Yeah, oh, good times, eh? Okay, I don't remember this tackle either, but did Nonu ever apologise after he shoulder charged you to the next year versus the Landers?
Oh, yeah, I remember that. I ducked the tackle from Horry. Ball spat out of the ruck, and I went to pass it, and Horry went to tackle me, and I don't know how I got out of it. I ducked under it, broke through, and I knew, obviously, Nuggy was there, so I tried to make sure that tried to push off Nuggy so I can try and get off. Fended Nuggy, spun around, and I was like, this is going to hurt. Skucks come flying at me, shoulder charge me, and as soon as I hit the ground, I remember going, oh, bro, that fucking hurt. And then after he goes, why didn't you get up? I said, you try getting up when there's a truck that hits you. You wouldn't be getting up that quick, mate. But yeah, I was thinking, how am I going to get this guy back after all these years? So even though we were best mates, you know, he was on the other end of the field. And then, yeah, I caught the massive hit from Skucks. But then he caught up after. And we went, sorry, I was like, you're not sorry. There was your one chance to put a hit on me. I know how this works. When your mates are on the other side, like best mates, you try and put a hit on them no matter what, whether it's legit or not. But I remember seeing a video of my eldest girl when that happened, and the video of her, she was quite young at the time. She was cute too, and she's like, Uncle Ma'a hurt my dad. And now Uncle Ma has to get a timeout. Skucks obviously got Simbin, so. But honestly, I remember that. It was pretty funny. And sore at the same time.
Oh, that's crack up. Okay, last one. Best piece of advice you have for a Woodlad listener?
Ooh, depends. If it's down the path of being a sports person, I guess, you know, similar to what my upbringing was, play as many sports as possible. Try not to fixate yourself on one sport, because the amount of learnings you get from different codes. I played basketball growing up. It wasn't the greatest, but, you know, the learnings I got from being able to, you know, learn about structures and how it works, you know, things like that, and then you go away and play games like touch, where you're learning how to beat players individually, or you're trying to suck people in so that when they do come out, you can throw long balls to whoever's open on the edges. To even netball, I played a lot of netball growing up, indoor and outdoor. And it was just all the learnings that I got from every code that I played in sort of helped me see different things. So if it's a kid coming through college, you know, don't be so stuck on playing one sport. Like, honestly, if you watch players that know how to play with instinct, it's because their background is they've played flag, touch, basketball, bit of netball, anything to sort of help shape who they are. They even play soccer because, you know, you might be dominant on your right foot, but the more time spent kicking the ball with your left foot, making it so natural. I mean, you look at Johnny Wilkinson and Desi when they go to their bad leg, doesn't even look like it's their bad leg.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they're so accurate. And when they do shank it, you're just like, okay, maybe you just didn't, you felt rushed and hurried into making that kick. But like I said, piece of advice, like, for me, continue to do what you did when you were a kid. Mm. Play as many sports as you did. Learn off older people because, you know, you never know. I use all my learnings through rugby when I do speaking engagements to talk about culture, team culture, you know, hard times, you know, mental battles that I had with myself. Mm. You know, I learned so much through footy. And that wasn't just because I played footy. I played, you know, all these other sports to help me understand how to read body language of players on the field or even on a court and try and execute something to make it work in a team's favour.
Mate.
But, yeah, I remember one thing was from, I think it was Michael Jones. He said, reach for the moon, and if you don't get there, you will always be amongst stars. So I've kept it. I've always kept it since then, so I've always tried to aim high, and if I don't quite achieve where I need to be, I know that I'll be around some great people.
Mate, I like that. Even though the stars are above the moon, that is still a great quote.
Mm.
But that is probably why you're going to be one of the best mentors I think Wellington College will ever see. That is some great advice there to finish. What has been one of the best podcasts ever, almost 2 hours of... one of the best journeys and careers I think we've had on the podcast. I really appreciate you giving up your time, mate. You're an idol of mine growing up for the Canes. I used to love watching you play. So instinctive, like we've spoken about, really just read the game so well. And awesome to sit down and have a yarn with you and go through your journey and reflect on some pretty special memories.
Nah, bro. Thanks for having me. I've thoroughly enjoyed actually, you know, just yarning.
Mate, one of the greats. Appreciate it.
No, thanks, cuz.
Hey, guys, thanks for listening. And if you've got this far, I'm guessing you enjoyed the episode. So if you did, please give it a share if you can. And also cheers to our mates at Spates for sponsoring this episode. What a lad, what a lad.